Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Republicans and Democrats are both claiming victory today in the fight over judicial nominees, with Republican leaders hoping for a quick confirmation of Judge Priscilla Owen today to the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. But the real winners are the maverick moderates from both sides who forged a compromise. A bipartisan group of 14 senators signed a deal last night clearing the way for a floor vote on three of President Bush's controversial appeal court nominees. Under the pact, Democrats will allow up or down votes on Owen, as well as Janice Rogers Brown and William Pryor. In return, Republicans agreed not to change a Senate rule that would have blocked a filibuster on judicial nominees, including future Supreme Court nominees. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada hailed the compromise as a blow to the Bush administration.
Your attempt, I say to the Vice President and to the President, to trample the Constitution and grab absolute control is over.
Meantime, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist of Tennessee said he still wants to see a floor vote on all five of the nominees.
Investigate them and question them and scrutinize them and debate them in the best spirit of this body, but then vote.
Well, joining us on the line for some analysis of the compromise, Boston Globe Washington Bureau Chief Peter Kanellos. Peter, welcome.
Hi.
And as we said, the 14 senators who signed the compromise, led by John McCain, agreed to allow floor votes on the three judges we mentioned. No commitment was made to two other nominees. Do we know why?
They're more unacceptable to the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Well, and
for a range of different reasons. I mean, I think that Judge Priscilla Owen, who's coming forward, was probably the least objectionable to the Democrats, and so she and Janice Rogers Brown, along with Judge Pryor, are getting consideration, but mm-hmm. others are not.
Well, the 14 senators also pledged not to engage in filibusters of nominees under, quote, until extraordinary circumstances. What does that mean?
I don't think that's a sort of enforceable standard. I think it's sort of a moral commitment. If one were to, you know, see the situation deteriorate to a point where Democrats were filibustering numerous nominees and threatening filibusters early on of Supreme Court nominees, I think that the Republican moderates would probably feel betrayed. On the other hand, you know, if a figure came along who was an unusually polarizing figure, I don't think the Democrats would hesitate to filibuster, and I don't think they would see that as a violation of the agreement.
Well, we said, and many are saying, that the winners in this kerfuffle are the 14 deal makers, but who are the losers?
Oh, I think the Bush administration and Senator Frist are the big losers. I think that, you know, we've seen a style of politics that has sort of taken hold here in Washington of rallying the base, maximizing the base. You know, you don't need to win by a big margin. You just need to win by a small margin. Get all your people in line. And in a government that's been controlled by one party, I very much think the White House and Senator Frist wanted the Senate to operate more like the House, where the majority passes all the legislation on its own and the minority has very little voice. You know, this group of moderate senators has put a significant roadblock to that.
Well, we understand, at least according to the New York Times, that activists on both the left and right are also unhappy with the deal. You know, lobbyists put a lot of money into this issue. What's going to be the fallout from that?
Well, hopefully the fallout will be a better system of choosing judges. I think there's a lot of evidence that on both sides, the liberal side and the conservative side, the scrutiny of judicial nominees had sort of reached comical proportions, where small aspects of people's records were being extrapolated into interpretations of how they would vote on abortion and how they would vote on major economic issues and things. And when you really look at what these people's records are, there's nothing objectionable, nothing that would lead to the kind of dire predictions that you hear on both sides about some of these nominees and some of Clinton's nominees as well. So I think the role of these independent groups on the right and left is sort of spiraled out of control. So it's not surprising that they would be upset. And hopefully the system will become a little more rational and people will be scrutinized a little more rationally.
Well, and we'll see if this collegiality will hold with other issues that are coming up maybe as soon as this week. For instance, a vote this week could come on John Bolton, the president's choice for U.S. ambassador to the U.N., so we'll have to see if it holds on that as well. Peter Kanellos, Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, is Senator Hillary Clinton moving to the middle, or is she just being herself? The conservative right is accusing the New York senator of being a liberal masquerading as a moderate. The liberal left is worried the Democrat will sell out to the center as she eyes the White House in 2008. But what if Hillary Clinton is up to something completely new in American politics? She's already raised eyebrows by teaming up on health care reform issues with her former health policy nemesis, Newt Gingrich. Now they even seem to like each other. Well, brand Hillary is what one political pundit is calling Hillary Clinton's new and evolving approach to politics. New York Magazine writer Greg Sargent coined the term in an article he's written for The Nation magazine, and he joins us on the line from his home in Brooklyn to spend a few minutes talking about Senator Clinton. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And the cover of The Nation shows a wide-eyed Hillary atop a donkey with a big branding iron, branding her initials into the donkey's backside. Brand Hillary, what do you mean?
Well, brand Hillary is essentially the new kind of politics that I think it can be argued that Hillary Clinton is creating or has created in her 4 years in the Senate. By that, I essentially mean that she's taken her husband's small issue centrism and kind of remade it in her own image, in part by adding a keen focus on defense issues.
What do you mean by small issue centrism?
Well, I mean, Bill Clinton, one of his trademarks was he would make kind of big sort of oratorical gestures toward the center. I mean, remember when he declared that the era was of big government is over. But at the same time, gestures that were really hollow in many ways, even as he kind of advanced progressive causes kind of undercover in an incremental and therefore less threatening way. She's doing something very similar to that, but with kind of a key difference. I think where Bill Clinton triangulated away from the left, pitting center against left in order to sort of salvage his presidency, Hillary's doing something different. She's essentially pitting pragmatism against ideology on both sides. She's developing sort of an image as a hard-headed, common-sense-focused senator who is willing to pursue solutions that she thinks works, even if they rile up ideologues on either side.
Well, give us an example. You say ideologues on either side. Give us an example of both.
Well, if you take her abortion speech, now, it's something that obviously represented her position for a very long time.
Now, remind us of what she said.
She essentially said that the right way to proceed is to seek common ground with anti-abortion forces. Now, that's something that the small-minded pundits instantly just say, oh, she's moving to the center. I think something more complicated is going on. What she's trying to do is essentially subtly appeal to Republican moderates and get them to take a different view of those on their right. The way that happens is by proposing that there be more focus on contraception and ways of preventing unwanted pregnancies, forces the extreme right to oppose that. Now, by framing the issue in that way, she forces the right to reveal itself sort of as the extreme ones, and it drives a wedge between the far right and the moderate middle.
She also formed an alliance with Newt Gingrich, which stunned many on the left. What did she say to make him flip because he was her nemesis on health care reform?
Well, I mean, this is very interesting. Her approach on health care, I think, is really worthy of taking a good look at because it also sort of fits into the pragmatic versus ideologue politics that she's creating. Remember, Hillary Care was a big government takeover of health care, and it was essentially class warfare in some ways because it pitted employee against employer and created a lot of acrimony, which essentially brought the plan down in the end. What she's doing now is really quite different. She frames the discussion in a completely different way. She talks about health care reform as something that employers and employees would benefit from. In speech after speech, she refers to CEOs who visit her in her Senate office and tell them, you know, we can't take this anymore. We're just getting killed. Healthcare, we need reform. So obviously that's a pretty dramatically different way and a very shrewd way of framing it.
And one that, as you write, Newt Gingrich can embrace. You observed Hillary Clinton campaigning in upstate New York recently. She was campaigning for re-election to the Senate in 2006. And in so doing, she appeared before two very different audiences. And you saw two different Hillarys. Tell us what you saw.
Sure. I mean, the first audience that she appeared before was sort of a close-to-the-press Democratic fundraiser. So obviously she kind of shed her typically demure and bipartisan image and gave these people what they wanted, which was an attack on on the GOP. But at the same time, she was shrewd enough to recognize that these were not red meat craving activist DENIAC types by a long stretch. They were really more sort of rural, small town Democrats, moderate, librarians, teachers. So when she spoke to them, she was able to attack the GOP in a way that appealed to these people, because she essentially wove it into a larger narrative about America and American values, and sort of couched her criticisms as dismay with what the radical right is doing with American values and its image abroad. The second one was a dramatically different audience. It was a room full of 300 farmers, and I'm telling you, if you saw her there, you would not recognize the Hillary that had just been addressing the Democrats only a couple hours earlier. And by that, I don't necessarily mean that to be a criticism. I think it's really more a case of her being really a lot more in tune with her audience than people have given her credit for. I mean, all politicians have to speak to the audience that's in front of them.
You say she spoke about fuel prices, protecting farmers from foreign competition, but you also write that it was the tone, too, that struck you.
Well, that was what was extraordinary. I mean, she was really able to connect with these people. This was a heavily Republican part of the state, so you've got to assume the room was two-thirds Republican, which means that, you know, these are people that are predisposed to believe the worst of Hillary. But she was able to, A, on the one hand, show a mastery of their issues, but on the other, talk to them about their issues without kind of a whiff of condescension. And this is a woman who grew up in Illinois. She knows how to talk to these people, and she, you know, she was very folksy, but not at all, it wasn't labored or insincere. She actually really appeared to be talking to these people in a kind of, you know, comfortable, down-to-earth way, and to project an understanding of their issues that really kind of caught them off guard and left them pretty flabbergasted with what they'd seen.
Right. You write, her vowels grew flatter, little became lull, get became git, entire pronouns vanished, as in, heard there are some places in California selling gas for $3 a gallon.
Now, that was a very good imitation of what she did.
But Hillary Clinton's critics will say that this is proof that she's a phony, that she just puts on the face of the audience that she's in front of. What was your take on it?
Well, you know, this is one of those things that's never easy to answer about a really skilled politician. But her critics will criticize her no matter what. I mean, I think obviously she knows her audience, so she's calibrating the way she speaks, just like every one of us does. We speak to different people differently. But at the same time, it was really clear that she knew that she felt comfortable among these people and knew how to talk to them. There was a real sort of feeling of genuineness to it, and I think that, you know, it's not something you can fake in the end, and the audience was won over.
Greg Sargent writes about Brand Hillary for the current edition of Nation magazine. When we return, how the left views Hillary Clinton, and what about Bill? Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're looking at the politics of Senator Hillary Clinton, as apparently many other people are. In fact, independent pollster Scott Rasmussen has a Hillary meter on his website. Today's Hillary meter confirms the Democratic senator from New York has swung 6 points closer to the political center over the past few months. Well, that worries some progressives, who, for instance, looked askance at her vote to support the war in Iraq. Back with us on the line is Greg Sargent, author of Brand Hillary, an article in The Nation magazine, which argues that Hillary is up to something new in American politics, not her husband's famous third way of political compromise, but reaching out to moderates in both parties. And Greg, does the left feel abandoned by Senator Clinton, and is that a negative for her?
Look, one could argue that she's the best positioned Democrat to unite left and center in the Democratic Party, because she is able to sound moderate themes without losing her left. Joe Lieberman, when he does his kind of warmongering talk, it just drives people on the left crazy. There's no way they can forgive him. Mm-hmm. Kerry, too, was always viewed as suspicious by the left because of the way he attacked Dean. Hillary, because of her enemies on the right, will generally be forgiven by the left flank, I think, and you know, they'll stay with her in a way way that they might not stay with another centrist politician.
Well, what about some of the other things that people perceive as negatives? She's a woman. Anna Quinlan writes, she could cure cancer and there would still be complaints that she'd ignored heart disease. How are people feeling about a woman president?
Well, I mean, interestingly, some recent polls are showing that majorities are prepared for it. I mean, obviously, who knows what will actually happen when it comes down to it. But those are such difficult things to predict. It's so far off.
Speaking of polls, she has a 70% approval rating in New York. But tell me what some other polls are about the possibility of her running for a higher office.
Well, you know, interestingly, I think Democracy Corps did a poll, polled her up against Jeb Bush, and she won 50-47. Now, what that suggests is that, you know, without an extremely charismatic Republican, she's looking at, she has a pretty good shot at getting half the vote, and that seems to me to be not a bad place to be starting from.
Yeah.
You know, on the other hand, she starts with maybe 35-40% of the country dead set against her. So a charismatic Republican like Giuliani, you know, I would think probably would have a pretty good shot of beating her.
Right. And then what about what Ellen Goodman, columnist Ellen Goodman, calls the bill thing? Even people who may like Hillary Clinton might be leery of having, as Ellen writes, the bad boy back in the East Wing.
Well, I think there's no doubt that that's something that they have to figure out how to deal with. I mean, there just could be a lingering Clinton fatigue that people will just sort of say, you know, we've been down this road before. I just can't deal with this again.
Mm. You write about how Hillary Clinton is received by audiences when she goes to speak to them, but she's also been said not to be well received on television. She's said to be shrill. And how is she as a politician? How will she come across as a politician?
Well, I think there's no question that that's one of her problems because, I mean, this woman has really mastered retail politics, which is pretty critical in sort of the early primaries in New Hampshire and Iowa and stuff like that. That type of skill can really carry the day. I mean, if you remember, Kerry essentially won by staying in rooms and refusing to leave until he had persuaded everybody in the room that he was the guy. But the presidential race itself is obviously a much bigger stage, and retail politics gets kind of lost in the huge churning 24-hour news cycle. So, you know, that's a problem she'll have to overcome, no question. Her presence on TV is nowhere near as good as it is in person.
As you write, you've heard the arguments. She starts out with 40% of the country against her. She's going to energize the GOP turnout if she runs for president, not to mention fundraising, like no other candidate. Do the Democrats really think she is the best hope?
Well, I think there's a pretty vigorous debate right now going on about that. I mean, it's, you know, there are plenty of Democrats who are extremely worried, who think that that argument is right and that she would really have no chance. I mean, I think it's not as easy as all that. I mean, this is somebody who was expected to be quite unpopular among New Yorkers, and the truth is she really did astound everybody in the Senate and many in New York State with her performance in the Senate. It was totally unexpected, so predictions about her, I would argue, are pretty useless.
Yeah. And Greg Sargent, what about you? Again, you've spent a lot of time viewing Hillary Clinton for this article, Brand Hillary, in the current issue of The Nation magazine. What about you? Did you go in with a notion and come out with another?
Well, you know, I expected her to be impressive, but I was actually really surprised at just how capable she was at connecting with these various audiences. It was really quite striking.
And again, our critics on the right are saying that she's a liberal who's pretending to be a moderate. Her critics on the left are saying she has abandoned liberals for the middle. What do you say?
Well, my argument is that neither of those does justice to what's actually happening. First of all, taking the right-wing argument, it's just patently false. It's part of a larger effort to portray just about every Democratic nominee in the last three Democratic nominees as unprincipled and lacking core convictions. But it's false. She really is more moderate than people have given her credit for. Now, from the left, I can understand why some liberals would be pretty alarmed by her recent moves, but I would suggest that it really is less about distancing herself from the left than Bill Clinton's triangulating was, and really more about positioning herself as a pragmatist and someone in search of common sense government solutions to problems.
And someone who genuinely believes the things she says?
Well, I think one thing you could definitely see in her is that her interest in policy seems to be really genuine. I mean, I saw her sitting there listening to, you know, 5-6 farmers air really detailed gripes about how things were going in their business. And after about a half hour of that, she would go back and go through every one of their concerns, addressing each one of them by name with a complete command of what they had said, even though they had said it a half hour ago. And, you know, that kind of thing really flows from genuine interest, and it's very hard to fake.
Greg, thanks. Greg Sargent, contributing editor to New York Magazine. His article, Brand Hillary, appears in the current issue of The Nation magazine. And tomorrow on Here and Now, the Air Force Space Command wants to put weapons in space, including one called Rods from God. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Vatican watchers are scouring news reports for clues into what kind of Pope Benedict XVI will be. From Mexico comes an announcement that the Vatican will not be investigating 85-year-old Reverend Marcial Maciel, the founder of the religious order the Legion of Christ, who's been accused of sexually abusing at least 8 young men up to 50 years ago. A spokesperson says the order was told by the Vatican that Father Maciel unambiguously affirmed his innocence, but the Vatican has not clearly confirmed that. And Marion Lloyd, a correspondent for the Boston Globe based in Mexico City, says some of the accusers claim the Vatican told them the investigation's ongoing. Well, Marion joins us now, and we understand these accusers were initially urged to take their case to the church instead of courts. So if the church case is closed, will they take their case to the courts?
I think at this point, I haven't specifically asked them that, but I asked them before why they didn't take it to court, and I think a lot of them feel that the chances of getting any kind of resolution in the courts in Mexico would be very difficult because the statute of limitations, I think, pretty clearly has expired in the case. I think they also really want the church to resolve this. These are men who were in the church for, some in some cases, 20, 30 years, and still, I think, have some kind of faith that this should be resolved within the church. At this point, they are not giving up hope that the investigation is still going forward.
We understand, too, that the accusers were hoping that Father Maciel would be tried by the church, not so much for the abuse, but for the religious rituals that he performed around the abuse?
Well, basically, what it comes down to, I think, because the statute of limitations within the church for sexual abuse charges have also expired, they feel that the best chance is to pursue the crime of abuse of the sacrament of the confession. Essentially, within the church, you know, it says that you cannot pardon somebody who was an accomplice in a crime, you know, with whom you were an accomplice in the crime. So their allegation is that Maciel forced them to perform sexual acts that were against the church, and then pardoned them for those sexual acts. And that is would be a very serious crime within the church, which I believe I've been told is punishable by excommunication.
Well, weren't these allegations first brought before the church in the mid-90s? And wasn't it then Cardinal Ratzinger, who is now Pope, who launched the first investigation in the mid-90s? He shelved that investigation in 99 and then reopened it last December.
That's correct. It's not, Ratzinger's really, as far as I know, never spoken publicly about this, and all the information that's come out about it has been second or third hand. According to a Mexican priest, he claims that he was told that Ratzinger did not want to go forward with the investigation for fear of upsetting the late Pope John Paul II, who was a big admirer of Maciel. So one of the theories is that then in December last year, when Ratzinger felt like he might be a candidate for Pope, he didn't want to have this hanging over him, that he was someone who had been basically covering up a very high-level, important, you know, pedophile case in the church.
Marion, this is potentially the first decision by Pope Benedict XVI regarding possible clergy sex abuse. What's your sense of that? Can you put that in some context for us?
There are some people that say that they feel that Ratzinger himself was more kind of a loyal you know, acted in this way because he was a loyal foot soldier to the late John Paul II, and that in his heart of hearts really would like to pursue these cases. That I've been told by some people who have heard second or third hand comments from Ratzinger, both right before becoming Pope and since becoming Pope, talking about the desire to clean out the filth in the church.
Marion, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Marion Lloyd of the Boston Globe. Well, we turn now to Tom Roberts, editor of the independent lay newspaper, The National Catholic Reporter. And Tom, your thoughts first on Father Massiel and what seems to be the Vatican's dropping of his case.
Well, it's a surprise because we were under the impression that they were accumulating even more evidence than the accusations that are out there. The United States has developed some very stringent guidelines, and under those guidelines, Father Massiel, if he were a priest in the United States, simply would not be an active priest at this point.
Well, and obviously you're critical of what might be a Vatican decision, so I want to move to another matter with you because that type of criticism, at least in Catholic publications, seems to have been punished lately. Earlier this month, Father Thomas Rees, editor of the small but influential U.S. Catholic magazine America, was forced by the Vatican to step down after 7 years at his post. What was your reaction to his stepping down?
I was, again, surprised, but also really upset. This was a person who was, first of all, a model Jesuit and a model priest, someone who ran a magazine that been a hallmark of American Catholicism for, you know, 90 years, and has been a place where intellectual discussion goes on. Tom Rees was nothing if not fair and moderate. The editorial positions were sometimes more progressive, but certainly not out of the range of mainstream opinion within the church and certainly within the academic community.
But last year, America ran an essay that took issue with the church's position on same-sex marriage. Another article was critical of bishops who wanted to deny communion to politicians who supported a woman's right to an abortion, for instance, John Kerry. Mm-hmm. It's assumed that that type of writing rankled Rome, and an editor of another Catholic journal, the Reverend John Newhouse, points out that, you know, you don't expect Planned Parenthood to give a platform to a pro-life position. Why should a Catholic journal provide a platform for positions that are clearly contrary to those of the church? What do you think of his point?
Well, I think, first of all, his example, his analogy is extreme, but we'll drop that. I do expect a Catholic publication, unless it is a purely evangelical publication that thinks we have absolutely all the answers and there should be no discussion, to come up with those kinds of discussions. Reverend Newhouse himself, I'm sure, knows that there are people even within the hierarchy who would take issues on with some of the teaching and want to nuance some of it, wanted to have it discussed. Certainly there was wide disagreement among the hierarchy of the United States over the treatment of politicians and whether or not they should be able to receive the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. Within the realm of Catholic teaching, there's always been discussion. If we accepted that we had all the answers for all time, some of the basis for our teaching, some of the teaching itself that we've used, means that we would still be talking about women being, you know, partially formed men, and inferior to men. We would still be talking about the earth being the center of the universe. I mean, there are things that have evolved over time because we've accepted the wisdom of disciplines outside of the disciplines of theology and philosophy.
And Tom Roberts, how much do these two decisions, the firing of Father Rees and the apparent decision in Mexico, what do they say about the reign of the new Pope Benedict?
I would think, first of all, that the removal of Father Rees was done certainly with Benedict's understanding and knowledge, and that if indeed the investigation of Father Massiel has been dropped, it was also done with his knowledge. And if that's the case, there are two very quick messages, it seems. One, we are going to tolerate absolutely no discussion, even in the most moderate form and most moderate and fair form. And two, you know, the sex abuse crisis, we really haven't learned anything about it. We're going to continue to protect priests who have been accused and protect them with church law, and we're not going to listen to the victims. I mean, I can't conclude anything but that if indeed that's the case. And that would be really sad and, I think, demoralizing for large segments of the church.
Tom Roberts is editor of National Catholic Reporter. Tom, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And for more on this issue, go to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Three people have died after receiving organ transplants that would normally have saved their lives, but instead transmitted a virus picked up from a pet hamster. Health officials are now saying that the organ donor, a woman from Rhode Island, picked up the virus from her hamster before she died from an unrelated stroke. Then doctors unknowingly transferred the virus, called LCMV, through donated organs, livers, lungs, and kidneys. The transplants took place in early April, and the recipients died 3 weeks later. A fourth person is recovering at Rhode Island Hospital. Joining us on the line is Felice Fryer, medical reporter for the Providence Journal. And Felice, we have to educate ourselves. This virus is relatively harmless in healthy humans. So why was it so disastrous for these transplant patients?
Well, as soon as you put a transplant into a patient, you have to prevent that patient's body from rejecting the transplanted organ. So the patient is filled up with anti-rejection drugs that essentially shut down the immune system. So they're defenseless, and the virus could run rampant.
Yeah. And when did doctors start to realize they had a problem that could be traced to a pet hamster? I mean, it sounds like you'd have to do some detective work there.
That's exactly what was involved. The infectious disease specialist who works with the transplant team at Rhode Island Hospital, Dr. Stacy Fisher, had two patients who were referred to her who just received kidneys. I'm not sure how many days had passed. It was a few days. And they both had the same symptoms. They had diarrhea, they had inflammation of the liver. They don't normally occur together. And plus, the two patients had the same problem. Mm-hmm. So she could tell something was amiss. Then she noticed that they both got their transplants on the same day, and she went to check and see if it was from the same donor. And from there, she went and checked on what had happened to other organ recipients from the same donor and found that one was about to die and the other had already died. So at that point, that's when the CDC and the various health departments became involved in the investigation.
And ultimately, they went to the donor's home where even though the donor had passed, the pet hamster was still there and was tested. Now, we want to be clear, too, the donor's organs were tested and cleared, but not tested for this virus, LCMV. Is that usual?
Yes, this virus is very, very hard to detect, and there was no reason to even think of looking for it. There had been only one other case where the virus was transmitted through an organ transplant, and that was in 2003 and hadn't actually been published. So it was not widely known that this was even possible. The other thing is that the test isn't commercially available. There's no way for hospitals to routinely test for this, and it takes so long to get a result that the organ isn't going to be viable by the time you find out.
So I'm sure doctors are looking to the future. What possible changes can they make to prevent this from happening in the future?
This was such an unusual event, it may not be something that's going to lead to any changes at this point. Someone's going to have to come up with a better test before this could be a routine test. Mm-hmm. I mean, this person, after these people died, the CDC got samples of tissue and blood from the donor, and to date, they still haven't been able to detect the virus in her, so it's just not easy to find.
Well, and back to this virus itself, you know, parents whose children have pet hamsters running around a cage, what should they do? I mean, how serious is this virus?
It's not very serious for healthy people. In fact, most people who get infected with it don't have any symptoms at all. And if you do get symptoms, you tend to get better within a few weeks. But if you want to play it safe, wash your hands after handling the pet. Don't kiss it. And if you clean the cage on a surface where there's some dirt, just wipe it down with the bleach solution. It's pretty easy to avoid it with some common sense hygiene.
And anything else we should know about this, Felice?
Yes, pregnant women should take special precautions if there are any pet rodents or if they find out that they have mice in the house. Actually, it's the common house mouse that is the main source of this virus. It's not commonplace, but it does happen that if a woman in the first or second trimester becomes infected with this virus, it can be passed to the fetus, and the fetus can have problems. So pregnant women need to take extra precautions.
And so it sounds as if pregnant women and transplants, this is really the only way that the virus can be passed.
That's right. It doesn't pass person to person except from mother to fetus or in these recent cases with the organ transplants.
Felice Fryer, medical reporter for the Providence Journal. It must be quite a shock to the medical community there.
Yeah, it was very upsetting, especially for the kidney transplant recipients because they're not about to die. They're miserable. They're on dialysis, but they could have continued on dialysis for a while longer, and now one of them died.
Felice, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now with this brief news note. A website known for carrying statements by al-Qaeda in Iraq is reporting that the group's leader, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, has been wounded. The site is calling on Zarqawi's supporters to pray for his recovery. The posting could not be verified and doesn't say how or when Zarqawi might have been injured. Earlier this month, the U.S. military was investigating a tip that Zarqawi was being treated at a hospital in Ramadi in central Iraq, but escaped capture. Zarqawi is public enemy number one in Iraq, with a $25 million reward for information leading to his capture, and he's believed to be responsible for a wide array of kidnappings and beheadings. Canadian author Margaret Atwood was there. So was Jonathan Franzen and Salman Rushdie, who, by the way, was seen mingling with E.L. Doctorow. It was the first ever public festival of international literature. It was held in New York City last month and put together by the Pen American Center, the world's oldest international literary association. We sent Here and Now critic Bill Marks to be our representative. He's back, and he has more to tell us about it. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Robin.
Well, the first ever public festival of international literature, one asks, what took so long?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, in most major cities around the world now, international fiction conferences are, they're just usual. It happens every year, and they're becoming more and more popular. And perhaps Pen America took notice of that. I asked Salman Rushdie, who's the president of Pen America, why it took so long, and here's his response.
It has to do with freedom of speech issues and protecting writers in trouble and so on, and the energy of the organization has always gone there. But what we felt, I felt certainly, is that first of all, raising the profile of Penn helps all that other work. You know, the more authority Penn has as an organization, the stronger its voice is, you know, when it deals with writers in trouble and persecution and tyranny and so on. But also, writing is an international thing. I mean, writers are not confined by national boundaries, nor is the imagination. And we felt that there is, in the last few years, there's been a kind of, certainly at the political level, there's been a kind of shutting down of the global conversation. You know, it seems as if America and the rest of the world, there's a kind of dialogue of the deaf going on. And we felt that's bad for America and bad for the rest of the world. You know, and that we, at least at this level, at the level of culture, we should do something to reopen that conversation. And that made it, we thought, more than usually important to have the world's voices coming to speak in America, to allow American voices to speak back, to engage them in disputes. So that was really where it came from.
It's funny, Bill Marks, listening to Salman Rushdie, I'm reminded that we had Jonathan Safran Foer on the program recently, and he said, there should be more of an exchange of books, you know, it's sort of his solution to world peace. I don't know. I mean, that's awfully simple, but Salman Rushdie seems to make the same point.
Well, he's making the point that, you know, we have been continually, unfortunately, been a sort of a provincial culture. Let's face it. I mean, the amount of books and translation that have been published in America have been very small, even though books and translation from Don Quixote, which recently celebrated its 400th birthday, to the Bible, are in translation. So the idea here is to try to bring America out of this sort of isolation booth that it's placed itself in by listening to voices and writers from around the world. And what could be more, make more of a visceral impact than stories rather than simply nonfiction books on what's happening in various countries?
To make that point, some of the literature Penn sent out, I read that of the 185,000 adult trade books published in English in the U.S. last year, only 874 titles were translated.
I know. And also, I guess one point that Rushdie is too polite to make, but which I'll make, is that there's a lot of great writing around the world, writing that is as great, if not greater, than writing that we see here in this country today. So on readers, it's a richness that's being missed. On our own writers, in a sense, that provincialism means that they can't look out in the world and maybe pick up new techniques and new ways of looking at the world.
Well, we want to hear some of those writers, but first, tell me a little bit about this festival, because I mean, I just to think of Rushdie in conversation with Doctorow, and you know, it just seems like you must have been giddy.
Well, giddy is the word. I mean, Rushdie was very giddy, partly because this has been an overwhelming success. And a lot of people wanted to see Rushdie and E.L. Doctorow. They wanted to see Bay Dao and Gish Jen and a number of writers get together and talk about pressing issues. Rushdie mentions politics, and there was a certain political element to some of the panels, not all the panels. My favorite panel that I went to where I was sort of giddy is a panel called Confronting the Worst, Writing and Catastrophe. Now, it doesn't sound like the sort of sexiest thing, but it's fascinating because they had writers from around the world talking about how do you write about the unspeakable, the unmentionable, you know, things that people don't want to know about, and what can a writer bring, perhaps, that CNN and news sources can't.
What did they decide?
Well, they basically decided that, in a sense, what they were trying to do was impossible, but that they had to do it, that they had a mission, in a sense, to bring the voices of the witnesses of catastrophe to a larger public, and that, in a sense, you had to give up the idea that you were going to be changing the world by doing it. You simply felt that it had to be done, assuming that perhaps somewhere down the line something would happen. But the idea was also that these writers could provide an unofficial version of what was going on rather than the version that was given by your typical journalistic sources, that by getting really down and talking to people, spending time there, not just going there, giving a certain, you know, 5-minute news bite story, but spending months living with people, talking to people, that they could provide an insight into what happened in Chernobyl, which is what one of the books was about, called Voices from Chernobyl. She spent years talking to the people who lived there, and it's a fascinating book.
Well, we understand that the primary reason for the festival was to generate interest in foreign literature, you know, perhaps foreign fiction, as you said, maybe better than some of the works being written here. But isn't that a tall order, given that we understand that Americans are reading less novels? I mean, you look at the bestseller list, and it's populated by, you know, Jane Fonda and or Bill O'Reilly. And so how are you going to get them to read fiction from another country?
Part of what Pan America is up to is a sense to give exposure to these writers. In other words, one way you get people to read is at least get their names out. And this was one way, an international literary festival, which got a certain amount of publicity. I'm hoping next year it will get even more, but it got some.
Well, and it got thousands of people. They had to turn away.
They turned away, I think, 5,000 people. So that indicates to me that the word does make a difference, that there are people who find nourishment in reading the word from books from other countries, and that it's partly just a matter of simply getting the word out and having an exposure through a festival like this.
Right. Well, let's get some of these names better known and some of these titles better known. Get your pencils ready, although we'll have it on our website as well. What were some of the books that struck you?
Well, first, let me just say that there's a program which is called Reading the World. It's made up of over 100 independent booksellers around the country. They are basically pushing 10 titles from large publishers and also small publishers. They're going to give displays. They're handing out lists and so forth to try to get people to read these books in translation. So in a way, the Pan America Ready has done some good. Okay, now that I've given you my little preamble here, I can now let me give you some of the names. I happen to love a book called Bakake, which is by Witold Gombrowicz. This author is not alive. Some of the books in translation are by dead white males. Sorry about that, but it happens. And but this is a collection of short stories, which is sort of by a Polish writer, which are wonderfully surreal.
Spell that title.
The title is called Bacacay.
Okay.
And it's a wonderful collection by what I think is like one of the great novelists of the century.
Okay.
And also Three Trapped Tigers by G. Cabrera Infante, which is a Cuban novelist who just recently died. And this is another wonderful book. And then finally, I would say Kafka on the Shore by Haruki Murakami, which is the Japanese writer. He's quite fine.
Okay. Well, if you didn't have your pencil ready, the list will be at our website, here-now.org. Here Now critic Bill Marks, thanks so much for bringing it to us.
Well, thanks for bringing this up, Robin, because it's a really vital and important issue.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.